So last time we finished off, you know, writing down the full standard model. And so now we want to continue. Now we want to basically finish off today understanding it, understanding the, all of the relevant physics of spontaneous symmetry breaking, and in the process meet a couple more of the associated puzzles with the model. Okay, so first of all, to recap, so we had the following as our action. We have the terms for the gauge bosons, kinetic terms, scalar field term, scalar field kinetic term, and potential term, potential terms. The kinetic terms for the fermions. Long equation. And finally, the Yukawa terms, the Yukawa couplings of the fermions to the Higgs. So there were three of those. Q left could, well, I'll suppress the indices here. So Q left could couple to the Higgs, and go down right. The I guy, the I type Q left could couple to the down right from family J. So we had to write down a whole 3x3 Yukawa coupling matrix here. Now I'm just going to revert to matrix notation and stop writing down these family indices here. Okay, and then there was another term, which was like Q left bar couples through a different Yukawa matrix, U, Y up, to not the Higgs, but that transform of the Higgs that I defined last time, times the right-handed up quark, and finally the corresponding lepton term, the left-handed lepton doublet, and couple through yet a third Yukawa matrix, YE, to the Higgs and the right-handed electron. And then we also have to add the Hermitian conjugate of all those terms. Okay, now, in order to make my notation agree with the conventional one in what we're about to do, I want to make two little notational changes. Okay, first of all, I want to change the normalization for the non-abelian kinetic terms to 1/2 here. Okay, so that's just like I've absorbed a factor of root 2 into the definition of the gauge bosons. And then the reason I want to do that is that it'll be convenient to switch notation now. So, you know, remember previously if we had the gauge field G mu, that was a 3x3 traceless Hermitian matrix. We could expand that in a basis of, we could think of that as a set of 8 constant 3x3 Hermitian matrices are a vector space, an 8-dimensional vector space. These are 8 basis vectors, each of which is a constant 3x3 Hermitian matrix, the generators of SU3, and then times coefficient functions, which are just 8 coefficient functions, 8 gluon fields, each of which are all just real fields. Okay, so similar. So now when we calculate the field strength in a similar way, we'll find that that is also valued in the Lie algebra, just like the gauge field was. And so we can expand it too. Okay, in a similar way. We can expand it in exactly the same basis of eight generators. And now let's take the, it's convenient to take the, to choose the set of, you know, as with any vector space, we can choose a basis, and there's convenient ones and inconvenient ones. So a convenient one here is one that's orthonormal in the sense that if I take two different generators and take their trace, take their product and then take their trace, that that vanishes, but if they're the same, that the trace is 1/2. Okay, so that's a conventional choice. So if I take this, so imagine I go over here, I expand g mu nu is equal to g mu nu A times TA, and g mu nu B times TB. So I can pull out the real coefficient functions, g mu nu A and g mu nu B, from that trace, because they're not matrices. So I'm left with the trace of TA times TB. By that, I get to replace that by 1/2 delta AB. So in other words, the 1/2, we'll convert this back to a 1/4, and I can rewrite this expression. So I want to rewrite the top line like this. Minus 1/4 g mu nu A g mu nu A minus 1/4 w mu nu A, W mu nu A minus 1/4 B mu nu B mu nu. In other words, all of the traces have gone away. This is just a sum of 8 plus 3 plus 1 kinetic terms that are all the same, that are all just like the usual kinetic term for E and M. Okay. And then one other thing I wanted to change convention about is last time I defined H twiddle to be minus I sigma 2 H star. I said that, you know, that's this guy here. So let's just, before things get out of hand, change the convention to plus. That'll be the more conventional thing. And then we'll get formulas that'll match what you see in textbooks. Okay, now, in this expression, we have these three matrices, YU, YD, and YE, each of which is an arbitrary 3x3 complex matrix so far. Yeah.
Have you done the thing where you like gauge fix the Higgs so it looks like just one real scalar basically sitting in the bottom?
Not yet, but I will do that shortly. So far, no, but I will. So what I was going to say before we get to that, so at the moment, these three matrices, these are three different 3x3 complex matrices that are arbitrary, at least as far as, you know, yeah, as far as gauge invariants and Lorentz invariants are concerned, they're arbitrary. But most of the parameters in them, that's a lot of parameters, in those, that's a lot of free parameters in those matrices, but most of those are not physical parameters. So as a first step, let's remove the non-physical parameters from those matrices. Okay, so the way we learned my lesson that last time, I shouldn't write on this backboard. So to isolate the physical degrees of freedom, the first step is to perform a singular value decomposition. So if we have an arbitrary n by n matrix, I can always do a so-called singular value decomposition, which is I can rewrite it as V dagger, let's call it little y, view where, okay, this was an arbitrary n by n matrix, complex n by n matrix, but this is a real diagonal non-negative matrix. So y is like, so let's focus on the 3x3 case. So this is a complex 3x3 matrix, arbitrary, but y is real and diagonal and non-negative, so y just looks like y1, y2, y3, where these are all non-negative real numbers. And then u and v are two different, in general, unitary matrices. Okay, so you're familiar with the fact that if you have a Hermitian matrix, you can do an analogous diagonalization where these two matrices are the same unitaries. And so this is like a generalization. We can do this for a Hermitian matrix, but for an arbitrary matrix, we have to let the two unitaries be different. Okay, so we'll do that let's do that for each of our three matrices. So we'll rewrite yd as some unitary V sub D dagger times some diagonal positive real matrix little y sub D times some other unitary U sub D, and similarly for yu, we'll write it as V sub U dagger times little y sub U times big U sub U, and similarly for ye, we'll write it as V sub E dagger times little y sub E times big U sub E. Okay, so now notice what you can do. Let's start with the electron term. So we plug this in up here, and for that matrix YE, so we can just absorb this U sub E. Remember, this 3x3 matrix is acting on the family index here. This has indices ij, which is contracted with the family index I on this guy, and the family index j on this guy. H has nothing to do with it. It has no family indices, so forget about it. So we plug that expression in, and we get little y times u sub e, but that u sub e we can just absorb into a redefinition. We can rotate the definition of the e in family space to just absorb away that matrix. And similarly, over here we can absorb the V dagger E into L left. Okay, so in other words, let's define E right prime. Remember, this is again a three component vector corresponding to the three families, to be U E E right. And let's define L left prime to be VE times L left. And similarly, here, so if we did that, what would happen to this term is we would replace, it would now look like L left prime times little YE, which is diagonal, times H times E right prime. Okay, so we would just diagonalize that term. So let's do the same thing with this term. We'll similarly absorb U right. We'll similarly absorb the matrix U sub U into U right by defining U right prime this way. And similarly, we'll absorb the matrix V sub U into a redefinition of Q left. Okay, so far we've managed to absorb all of the unitaries in this term and in this term by field redefinitions. So now these two terms, you can just replace capital Y by little y, which is diagonal, here and here. Here, life is not, we can't do that because, you know, let me first make one comment, sorry. Notice that when we did these changes of basis, because these U's were unitary, they don't mess up. You know, remember previously we had discussed how the kinetic term for the fermions might have had extra matrices Kij in there that were not diagonal, not proportional to the unit matrix. And I said, oh, without loss of generality, we can do a rotation in field space to make that third line, the kinetic term, simple. So it's just diagonal in the family space. So first of all, notice that we're not messing that up here, because if you think about it, each of those terms, you know, when I do this field redefinition, I'll get a U from that one, a U dagger from that one. They'll just multiply together to give the identity back. So far we're good. So far with no pain, we've absorbed all the unitaries from here and here and diagonalized those. You know, here the problem is now if we try to absorb a U over here, that's fine. But if we try to absorb a U over here, well, we can do that, but then we'll undiagonalize this term because the same Q is appearing in both terms. So we can't, you know, we have six matrices here, but we only have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fermion fields to absorb them into. So there's one of them we can't absorb. That's the bottom line. So what we can do here is the first step. We can absorb U sub D into a redefinition of D right, but the remaining piece we can't absorb. And so what we're left with, what the bottom line becomes after that, is, so just rewriting the bottom line here, it becomes Q left. Now if you think about it, okay, so I do all this redefinitions and then at the end of the day, let me just drop the primes, okay? So I don't mean to confuse things, but so I'm gonna make this change, plug this in up here, so then I have a Lagrangian that has all the fermions now have primes on them, and then I'm now gonna do away with the primes again because I don't wanna carry them around for the rest of the lecture. So after I change, what I'll get, let me start with the later terms. So again, what I get for the second two terms here is plus Q left bar little YU, which is diagonal and real, times H twiddle times U right plus L left bar little YE, which is real and diagonal and positive, times H times E right. And then again, because in the first term, because we couldn't absorb everything, well, if you think it through, not only could we not absorb the V sub D dagger, which is over here, but also when we did a change of basis here, we inserted another VU in that term. In the process of absorbing it here, we unabsorbed it over here. Okay, so what we end up with over here is Q left times some unitary matrix, the so-called CKM matrix, times the Higgs times D right, where in our previous notation, VCKM, if you want to check that you understand what's going on, VCKM you can check is just VU times V D dagger. Okay, so that's some progress. Now it looks like we only have, and I forgot my little, I forgot this. There's also a little Y sub D here, which is real and diagonal. Okay, and actually we're not done absorbing yet. There's one more thing we should do. So VCKM, at the moment, this is just a unitary matrix. So a unitary matrix has 9 real parameters in it. 3x3 unitary matrix has 9 real parameters in it. But note that we can still, the question is, are we done absorbing things? We don't want to mess up. We've diagonalized this guy and made the diagonal thing real. And we've done that here too. We don't want to do anything that'll screw that up. But can we make any more field redefinitions to soak up some of the parameters here as being and reveal them to be unphysical? So the answer is yes. Let's, as long as we soak diagonally in field space, then we won't mess these guys up. So in other words, explicitly, if I now make another field redefinition where I say, where I redefine a new Q left prime to be, let's say Q left the ith family prime will be the old ith family of Q left times a phase e to the I alpha I, where this phase can also depend on what family I'm working with. Well, if I do the exact same thing to U right, then I won't do anything to this term because I'll pull along the diagonal, I'll pull a phase into this guy, but the complex conjugate phase into this guy, or let me say it another way. So this guy will spit out a diagonal matrix of phases, but this guy will spit out the diagonal matrix of the complex conjugated phases. And the thing in the middle is also a diagonal matrix, so those two phase matrices commute right through and kill each other. So nothing happens to that term. But into D right, I'll absorb a different phase. Okay, so D right I. I'll absorb a different generation dependent phase, beta I. And so it looks naively like in this way, I'm able to soak up six more phases, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, into the redefinition of the fields. Well, not quite, because if I did take all the beta I to be equal to all the alpha I's, then actually I would do nothing. I would do nothing to this. I wouldn't change this matrix at all by those field redefinitions, by the same argument for why I didn't do anything over here. So really I only managed to soak up 6 - 1 = 5 phases here, and so after I've done that, VCKM contains 9 - 5 = 4 phases. So strictly, so these are what these are 3 angles, real angles that rotate me between different families, and 1 unremovable complex phase. Okay. And so this was just a few years ago. Kobayashi and Moskawa got the Nobel Prize for realizing that if we had redone this calculation with only 2 generations of fermions, we would have been able to soak up all of the complex phases. We would have just been left with angles, real angles. And so at the end of the day, there would be no complex numbers in the standard model Lagrangian, no complex coefficients, and so if there were only 2 generations, if you have a Lagrangian where you can soak up all the complex coefficients, that thing does not violate CP. So Kobayashi and Moskawa back in the 70s noticed that, well, when people observed the violation of CP, they realized that meant there was a third generation, because if you did have a third generation, they went through this argument and they found, oh, well, we can't soak up all the phases. There's some unremovable physical complexity in the Lagrangian, and so they were able to predict 3 generations based on that. Okay, so let's see. So let's just summarize where we are now. So now we really have burrowed down to the honest to God standard model with its physical parameters. So what are the physical parameters? Well, on the top line, there's 3. There's the 3 gauge couplings, G3, G2, and G1. Those are just 3 dimensionless real numbers. On the next line, there's 2 more real numbers, M and lambda. On the next line, there's nothing new. And then on the final line, okay, so, well, the final line has become this. So what we have is VCKM, which has four real parameters. And then we have yd, little yu, and little ye, each of which are just diagonal real matrices. So they have 3, 3, and 3. So in total, we have 3 gauge couplings, plus 2 parameters in the scalar sector, plus 4 CKM parameters, plus 3 times 3 Yukawa couplings, for a total of 9 plus 9 equals 18 free parameters. And really, there's one more, because there's the theta angle of QCD from the Strong CP, the Strong CP angle, like I was mentioning yesterday. So 19 including theta of QCD. Okay, and the state of things at the moment is that those are all free parameters. No one knows an explanation for what any of the values are. So those are all, those parameters have now all been measured, except for theta QCD, where there's only an upper bound. But no one knows why they have the values that they do. Now, it's interesting to notice that if you look through this list, all 19 parameters are dimensionless except for one. Okay, so there's only one dimensionful parameter in the standard model. Yeah, so there's only one dimensionful parameter in the standard model, which is M, which is of order 10 to the 2 GeV. And let's, just to be a little bit more, just to be rough, let's say that's about 1 TeV. TeV is a tera electron volt, 10 to the 3 GeV. So that's the electroweak scale. And so,
So you're choosing to disregard the other theta angles.
Yes, I am. In fact, yeah, that's right. So they are, I believe they are not physical. They can all be rotated away. But I was going to, I'm going to get that argument straight for myself and then give it in a later lecture, if that's okay. But I believe they are unphysical, yeah. And I think let me give it in a subsequent lecture when I'm not going to screw up the argument. But, indeed, I don't believe they're physical observables. So now in the actual universe, in actual history, gravity was discovered first, and then the standard model was discovered later. But okay, let's for a moment imagine an alternative universe in which it went the other way around. After all, gravity is a lot weaker than the rest of these forces. So imagine people discovered the standard model first. Then they would think life would be pretty simple. You know, there's only one dimensionful number in the game. Everything else gets its dimensions from that. So everything is kind of, they would expect, well, the basic scale in physics is roughly a TeV. So then they learn that there's gravity, okay? So now the action for gravity has just two extra terms. Yeah, the action for general relativity coupled to the standard model, well, it has the standard model, and then it has two extra terms. There's the Einstein-Hilbert term, and then there's the cosmological constant term, the vacuum energy, which is just a constant that we can add to the Lagrangian. Okay, this is in terms of the cosmological constant. This is basically the Planck mass squared times the cosmological constant. But then the funny thing is that, so if we told this person that there was just this one extra field in the universe, G mu nu, and that they should just follow the same procedure we've just followed to write down the standard model, they would see that the only two extra terms you can write down that are Lorentz invariant, gauge invariant, in this case also diffeomorphism invariant, invariant under coordinate transformation, are these two. Well, really, these are the ones that are relevant at low energies. Actually, I'm not being quite right. There's also a quadratic and curvature. There are quadratic and curvature terms you can write down, but those are very difficult to observe at low energies. So, so they would naturally guess, if they had to guess the size of these two terms, they would guess, well, these are two more dimensionful coefficients. What values would they guess? They would guess they're something like this, maybe. And so anyway, they would be very surprised. So in fact, you know, M Planck is much, much bigger than that. It's 10 to the 19 GeV. 10 to the 18 maybe is better. And this has units of energy to the fourth. So if we take its fourth root to make it have units of energy, it has 10 to the minus 12 GeV. So in other words, M Planck is huge compared to the scale of particle physics, which is huge compared to the scale of the cosmological constant. So one way to describe this is that this person who was just finding out about gravity now would be shocked if expressed in terms of the cost in energy, expressed in terms of the cost in action, they would be shocked by the fact that there's a stupendously large cost in action for bending or curving space-time, and a stupendously small, much smaller than they would expect, cost for stretching space-time. This term is about curving space-time because it's proportional to the space-time curvature, R, reaching scalar. And this term is about stretching space-time because it's really just a constant times this integral is just the volume of space-time. So this is just, if I increase the volume of space-time by some amount, that coefficient tells me what the price I've paid in terms of action is. So somehow that's one way to say what the mystery is, that those are the two giant hierarchy problems in physics. The traditional particle physics hierarchy is this gigantic range of scales, and then this is the newer cosmological constant hierarchy scale. Okay, and then this is an even bigger hierarchy, of course. But so one way to say it is that from the standpoint of a particle physicist, gravity has these two weird properties. It's unaccountably hard to bend space-time, and it's unaccountably easy to stretch it. Where easy and hard, I mean this notion of cost, how much action it costs to do that. Maybe just one more thing to say. You know, there's a worth noting here is that there's a little bit of a numerologically interesting thing, which is that if we take the hierarchy here is about the same as the hierarchy there. For it's just another thing that we don't understand, but who knows, might have some significance. In other words, if you take the geometric mean of this guy and this guy, it's about equal to a TeV, the electroweak scale. Okay. So much for that. So now I want to plug in the Higgs-Vev. I want to do spontaneous symmetry breaking. So, as we mentioned last time, if we look at the shape of the Higgs potential, the Higgs potential is minus those last two terms on the second line. So if we draw it, it looks like uh, it looks like this, and really, you know, this is. So H really has four components and four real numbers in it. Because it's a doublet under SU2, it has two complex components. So in terms of real components, it has four. And because the potential only depends on H dagger H, well, H dagger H is phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared plus phi 4 squared. So the bottom of this potential is some the equation for the locus of points at the bottom of the potential, at the minimum, is some equation of the form phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared plus phi 4 squared equals something, some constant v squared. Or, sorry, I guess with my notation that I'm about to use, this is equal to some constant, which I'll call 1/2 v squared. But in any case, so this is the equation for a three sphere. Let me make life less gross, let me put the 1/√2 in here. So this is 1/2 times all of this stuff is equal to 1/2 e squared. Okay, why am I doing this? Anyway, so you don't get this. So this is the equation for a three sphere of radius v. So there's really some three-parameter sphere, three-dimensional manifold there. So the Higgs has to choose some particular place to sit on that manifold. So it does that. Okay. And so it obtains a vacuum expectation value, and its vacuum expectation value is something. Let's make a rotation. Let's write that as follows. So we'll use our freedom, the thing Justin was mentioning before. We'll use our freedom to make an SU2 rotation. It picks out some point on the three sphere, but then we'll, by a gauge transformation, change that to be the point corresponding to zero in the upper component and a real number in the lower component. And in fact, more generally, let's go into this gauge. It's common to go to this. It's conventional when describing this aspect of Higgs physics to go into this gauge where even when we include, we rotate into the frame where the Higgs doublet is zero in its upper component and real in its lower component everywhere in space. And it has this constant part, which is the VEV, which does not depend on space-time, and this part here, which is a real field now. Okay, so now there's a, just to avoid confusion, I'll try to stick to the following naming convention to try to clarify what I'm talking about. So this thing, which is a two-component vector with complex entries, I will call the Higgs doublet. It's the thing that gets a VEV. This thing, capital H, which is a single component real scalar field, I will call the Higgs boson. This is the thing that has been observed at CERN. Okay. So we take this expression for little h and we plug it in to the above Lagrangian, and we just rewrite the whole thing. We remove little h from the Lagrangian altogether and rewrite the whole thing in terms of the constant V and the real scalar field H. And so what we want to understand now is what happens when we do that. It's the same Lagrangian. We're just writing it in a different way. But a lot of the symmetry of the Lagrangian is no longer manifest, but some of it still is. And we want to, the way you would describe the physical content of the Lagrangian looks different in those two ways of writing it. And this way, is the, in a sense, the physical way, the way the universe looks to a low energy observer, since the universe really is in this spontaneously broken phase. Okay, so let's start with, well, okay, so let's first talk about, I mentioned it will look like some of the symmetry is broken, other of the symmetries are not broken. So how do we tell the difference? Well, so first of all, I remind you that the kinetic term for the Higgs was like this. So since it transforms trivially under SU3, the SU3 gauge field doesn't appear here, but it transforms non-trivially under SU2 and U1, according to that table, which I didn't write down this time. So so it has the following terms in here. Okay, that's the SU2 term. It's I times G times, now we used to write just I times G times omega mu, but again, I want to split this now into omega mu A times the generator TA for SU2. So this is the generator TA for SU2. You can check that it satisfies the condition that I, the normalization condition that I wanted here. This sigma A over 2, the over 2 here is, one way to say it is that it's precisely so that it satisfies exactly that condition, the trace of TA dB is equal to 1/2 delta AB. And then there's the other term, which was the one we had before, IG1 times the hypercharge of the Higgs, which is 1/2, times d mu. Okay, so in the whole standard model gauge group, there are, what do I want to point at here? So in the whole standard model gauge group, I don't have anything to point at, but for SU3 times SU2 times U1, there are 8 plus 3 plus 1 generators. But of those 8 plus 3 plus 1 equals 12 generators, there's a subset of 4 generators that act non-trivially on the Higgs. So there's some four-dimensional subspace of the Lie algebra that acts non-trivially on the Higgs, spanned by the 3 SU2 generators. Okay, so spanned by the 3 SU2 generators, T1 equals 1/2, 0, 1, 1, 0, T2 equals 1/2, 0 minus I, 0, T3 equals 1/2, 1 minus 1, 0, 0, and let's call it Y, the hypercharge, which is this 1/2, and then it just is, in terms of the 2x2 structure, it's just a unit matrix. Okay, so those are a basis for the four-dimensional subspace that acts non-trivially on H, but within this four-dimensional subspace, there is a one-dimensional subspace that does act trivially on HVEV. Okay, namely, if you look for a linear combination of these four, which has the property that it kills the VEV, that equals zero when we multiply it by that, well, that there's a unique linear combination which is called Q, which is Y plus T3. If you notice, Y plus T3 is just the matrix 1, 0, 0, 0. And if you act with that matrix on that VEV, it does indeed vanish. So yeah, this is no longer an equation, sorry. Okay, so that's the electric charge. So we have, so now if we look at the generators that act trivially on H, in other words, the generators that kill H when they act on it, well, there's Q, and then there's all the SU3 generators. Remember, they, right from the get-go, right from when we wrote down our table, they all acted trivially. So the generators that, the subgroup of Lie algebra generators that act trivially on H are the ones that generate the unbroken gauge group of the low energy standard model. So the remaining generators are Q and all of the three, what should I call them? Not confuse them with, well anyway, these are the SU3 generators, TA, so there's eight of these. And so the symmetry, the unbroken symmetry, is U1 electromagnetism, the U1 generated by this generator, times SU3 color. And the idea is that, you know, well, let me just make sure if I, did I forget to say anything? So the idea is that when you, if we were, if we had been dealing with a symmetry, with a group where SU3 times SU2 times U1 was a global symmetry, not a gauge symmetry, so there were no gauge bosons in the game, and then the Higgs obtained, then the scalar field obtained a VEV like this, well, we started with an H initially had four real components. We had four generators, but a one-dimensional subspace of those generators acts trivially on the VEV. The remaining three dimensions that don't act trivially on the VEV, those three generators are broken by the VEV. The symmetry they generate is broken by the VEV. Oh, let me explain that. Sorry, I should have said. So why do we care? Why do we care that this guy doesn't affect the VEV, whereas someone not in this 1D subspace does change the VEV? You know, the answer is just that one way to think about it is that, okay, so in the low energy theory, V no longer looks like a field. Once we've taken little h and we've rewritten it as V plus big H, now the Lagrangian is full of these Vs, they just look like coefficients in the Lagrangian. And when we talk about a symmetry in a gauge theory, it's supposed to leave the coefficients in the Lagrangian alone. It transforms the fields, but it doesn't, you know, transform the mass to some other mass or something like that. It doesn't change, you know. So this symmetry generator, when it annihilates, the fact that this Lie algebra generator equals zero on this guy means that the corresponding group element, remember the symmetry generated by this Lie algebra element is obtained by exponentiating it. Okay, so then we're talking about e to the iq acting on v. Well, if q acting on v is zero, this is e to the I zero, which is So it just acts trivially. It doesn't change it at all. So any generator that acts that annihilates V generates a symmetry that leaves V constant, leaves the VEV of the Higgs constant. So it does look like a symmetry from the low energy Lagrangian. By contrast, if you have any generator that does not annihilate V and you exponentiate it, then that's giving some non-trivial transformation here. So V is getting transformed into some, you know, this whole thing is getting transformed, and that's messing up the symmetry broken Lagrangian. It doesn't look like a symmetry transformation from the standpoint of the low energy observed. So we had these four components that of the scalar field, we also had four gauge bosons. We also had four generators that symmetry generators that acted non-trivially on H in principle, but three of those were broken in this sense. Okay, so by Goldstone's theorem, that means that says that four of these real components would have to become. Did I say four? I meant three. The number of broken generators is the number of Goldstone bosons, massless bosons that should appear in the spontaneously broken theory. So three Goldstones with. So three of these four real scalar fields, after we plug in the VEV for the Higgs, Goldstone's theorem says that three of the scalar fields will look like they have vanishing mass terms, and one of them will be a massive scalar field. Okay, and that's intuitively, we were in this four-dimensional field space, and we said that the VEV was a three-dimensional submanifold, a three-sphere. The minimum was a three-dimensional subspace, a three-sphere. So the three Goldstone bosons are the three scalar fields that parameterize moving around the sphere while staying on its surface. The one non-Goldstone boson, which will get a mass, is the scalar field that parameterizes moving in the radial direction, where you can see there is a cost in energy. As you go up or down here, there's some curvature in the potential energy, and that's exactly what the mass measures. Whereas going around the sphere, there's nothing. It's the potential is completely flat. Okay, so that would be the story if there was no gauge symmetry. And then famously, if instead we say, oh, these symmetries we were talking about actually were gauge symmetries, then there's this so-called Higgs mechanism that happens. Where, in words, people say, now, in addition to the three Goldstones that the scalar fields that parameterize moving around the three sphere, there's also associated with each of the three symmetry generators that generate those motions, there are gauge bosons. And the idea is that those gauge bosons, which in the symmetric theory were all massless, the three that generate that symmetry, those all end up eating one of the three Goldstone bosons and becoming massive. So instead, now we have the three Goldstones get eaten, and we get three massive vector bosons called W plus, W minus, and Z, or in other words, W1, W2, and Z, we'll see in a moment. And the fourth, the remaining gauge bosons remain massless. So the fourth linear combination of gauge bosons corresponding to these, so what we'll see in a moment is that the gauge bosons corresponding to this guy and this guy get massive, a certain linear combination, and those are called W1 and W2, or W plus and W minus. A certain linear combination of these guys, the corresponding gauge boson becomes massive, it's the Z. And then the other gauge boson, which corresponds to the linear combination Q, doesn't get massive, it remains massless. And that's the photon. Okay, so let's just see that quickly, more explicitly. Those are the words. Uh-oh. I'm going too slow today. Uh, Okay, how should I do this? So, let's just say it this way. So, to see how that happens in practice, let's look at the kinetic, let's focus on the kinetic term for the Higgs boson, minus d mu h dagger d mu h. Okay, let's look at what d mu h looks like again. Let's substitute in, again, h equals v plus capital H, but just forget about capital H for the moment. Let's just focus on the terms just involving v. So d mu times h, when we just look at the VeV part, is partial mu plus ig2 sigma a over 2 w mu a plus ig1 times hypercharge a half times d mu, all acting on 1 over root 2 0 v. So of course the partial derivative will die on the constant bev. So you can simplify this a little bit to I over 2 root 2. So I'm just pulling out that those 2s and that root 2. And then, so just to write out this matrix explicitly, it's g1 b mu plus g2 w mu 3 g1 b mu minus g2 w mu 3 and g2 times w mu 1 minus w mu 2 and g2 times w mu 1 plus I w mu 2. So that's equal to IV over 2 root 2. And then V just selects out this part. G2 W mu 1 minus I W mu 2. And then G1 V mu minus G2 W mu 3. Okay, so now when we square this thing, it becomes minus v squared over 8. 2 root 2 squared is 8. And then, okay, so we square this. We take this times its dagger. We'll get from the top term, we'll get g2 squared times w mu 1 squared plus g2 squared times w mu 2 squared. And then from the bottom term, we'll get plus g1 b mu minus g2 w mu 3 squared. Okay, but now the Lagrangian for massless electrodynamics is minus 1 quarter f mu nu f mu nu. And that will give the field equation box a mu is equal to 0 in Lorentz gauge. The Lagrangian for a massive vector boson is, you have to add the mass term, 1 half a mu, 1 half m squared a mu, in which case this will become the appropriate massive wave equation. Okay, so, but for W1 and W2, that's exactly what we have. We have the kinetic terms here, minus 1 quarter W1 squared, and then minus 1 quarter W2 squared, and then minus W1 squared, W2 squared, without not the field strengths, just the gauge fields themselves. So in other words, this is the mass term. This is the mass term. If we just pull out a 1 half here, what we're saying is that the mass of the W mu 1 and W mu 2, in other words, we've learned that they have masses given by the square of their mass is given by the Higgs bev over 4 times G2 squared. So that's the mass of the W boson. Now here we have a little matrix we would need to diagonalize. So let me just very quickly describe that. So we can write this part as, you know, it's easy to check that you can rewrite this term as minus 1/2 times the vector W mu 3 B 3 times some mass matrix M, 2 by 2 mass matrix M squared times this times the column of this W mu 3 B mu, where M squared, the mass matrix, is just B squared over 4 times G 2 squared G 1 squared minus G 1 G 2 minus G 1 G 2. And then if we diagonal, so then this is just a 2 by 2 matrix, it's easy to do the eigen, it's easy to diagonalize it, and you just calculate its eigenvalues and corresponding eigenvectors. And when you diagonalize it, well, it's just equal to some orthogonal matrix O transpose times the diagonal matrix M squared times the orthogonal matrix O, where you'll see that this diagonal matrix is given by B squared over 4 G1 squared plus G2 squared, and then 0 in the other component. And the corresponding O, probably can't even see the board over here, the corresponding O is just a 2 by 2 rotation matrix, cosine theta W minus sine theta W, sine theta W, cosine theta W, where cosine theta W and sine theta W, if you just work it out, you'll find that they are given by G2 over the square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared, and G1 over the square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared. So in other words, if we think in this parameter space, if we look in G1, G2 space, and the actual gauge couplings in the standard model are some point here, G1 and G2, then theta Weinberg is this angle. So this is the theta sub W is this famous Weinberg angle in the standard model. And the I'm rushing through this all too much. So I thought maybe I should, okay. I'm discouraged that I lollygagged my way through the lecture and didn't get through things, but I shouldn't rush it and make it incomprehensible at the end. So, So, I'll raise this board in 1 second. But so if we then define new gauge fields Z mu and gamma mu, which are just the matrix O, this cosine sine minus sine cosine, times the original gauge fields W mu 3 and B mu, then we'll find that these guys have exactly, if we rewrite the kinetic terms, gauge boson kinetic terms for W mu 3 and B mu in terms of Z mu and gamma mu, they won't change because we've just done an orthogonal transformation. They'll just be, this is the photon A mu. So they'll have they'll have the usual same kinetic terms as before, as long as we just look at the quadratic parts. And then this non-diagonal part of the mass term here will have diagonalized, and it's the only non-zero part is the mass term for the z, where this mz is the non-zero eigenvalue in the matrix, in the diagonalized matrix we just had. So it's v squared over 4 times g1 squared plus g2 squared. Okay. Well, we were almost at the end of describing the structure of the standard model. So it was just the last step was to explain the vector bosons and their masses, and which ones were massless and which ones weren't, and to describe the fermions and their masses. But I rushed through the end, and so I feel that I did not do a good job of explaining those last few minutes. And let me not do the fermions now, I'll continue those next time. So we're almost done with the standard model. So close. Anyway, that's it. Any questions about that? Apologies for, I feel like that train wreck, too fast. Incoherence. Any questions or notes? Let me ask another thing. That was obviously not very clearly run through. But is it? Has everybody seen this before enough that this is a review that we don't need to go through again, or did I? Okay, I won't go through it again. But if I confuse anyone with the end of that lecture, then please come talk to me so that you're not totally confused for the rest of your life about that. That's right. Okay.